It's Hosea chapter 2, verses 2 to 13. Rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land, and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children, because they are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my olive oil and my drink. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers, but not catch them. She will look for them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take away my corn when it ripens, and my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her naked body. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed festivals. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers, but me she forgot, declares the Lord.
It's quite a shocking passage, and it focuses as adultery as the metaphor for our unfaithfulness to God. Because it's such a shock and such a kind of bold metaphor, I just thought I should say that if unfaithfulness in marriage is something that you've been guilty of in the past, then please remember at this point and through the rest of the service that that has been dealt with, that Jesus' blood has covered your sin if you have come to him and asked for forgiveness. Equally, if you're someone who has suffered because other people have been unfaithful to you, because someone else has betrayed you like this, I hope you can see that in this passage, God sees you. He knows your pain. But for all of us, in some way or another, we have been guilty of unfaithfulness to our Lord. We've been guilty of forgetting the Lord and going after other gods, other masters that cannot satisfy us.
Continuing from verse 14. Therefore, I'm now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land, so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people, and they will say, you are my God. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. Then I told her, you are to live with me for many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. For the Israelites will live for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterwards, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days.
Father, please help me as I preach, and please help us as we listen to your word. Please help us to see your heart towards us through what you have to say to us in this passage. Amen. Rebuke your mother. Rebuke her. Happy Mother's Day. Someone's trying to get in at the back. I have a confession. I forgot that it was going to be Mother's Day when I was preaching this, so this is not a deliberate kind of swipe at everyone's mothers. I know my mother is going to be listening to this recording later. So, Mom, when you hear this, it's not about you. And it's not about you personally either, if you're a mother or a wife or a woman. Or even if you've been adulterous in the past. This is primarily about Israel and God's relationship with her. It's mirrored in the life of Hosea. So in some ways it's not about us, but at the same time it is about all of us. And there's a bit of a tension between those two things. So try to remember that the specific judgment, the specific details of these things are not directed on us as an individual for particular sins. Sadly, neither are the particular blessings. It's metaphorical. What we're trying to see here is the heart of God towards his people, using the metaphor of a husband and a wife. And what we're trying to see is that while it starts with judgment, this passage is really about how, even though we've forgotten God, that he calls us, his unfaithful bride, back to him in love. So maybe I should have chosen this on February 14th. It's more of a Valentine's Day passage. But here we go, Mother's Day. So to give you a bit of context, Israel is in a complete mess. And in the middle of that, Hosea is a prophet with a message. And part of the way that message is played out is God asks him to marry a woman. He's asked to marry a woman who he knows is going to cheat on her later. He obeys, and she does cheat on him. She has children, she, not him, she has children with very weird names. And with each new child and each new name, it becomes more and more obvious that she has been sleeping with other men and that they are not Hosea's kids. It's an extreme story and hard to relate to. And then when we look at this language in chapter 2, when God kind of responds back to her adultery, it's shocking. It's hard to read, and we want to just shut our Bible and pretend that Hosea chapter 2 doesn't exist. And partly because it's down to our instinct. We don't want to hear that kind of anger. We want to tone it down. And so we want to tone down kind of the things that cause that anger. We want to say the woman's not really that bad. Actually, the man is being a bit overly possessive. He's like an overly possessive boyfriend who's angry because he's been rejected. But it's not about a boyfriend and a girlfriend. It's not about like a casual relationship where either party can walk away and it's fine. This is about adultery. It's a married couple who had promised themselves to each other and to only each other. He has a right to expect faithfulness. Another way we try and kind of tone down the passage is to paint Hosea as a bit of a prudish hypocrite with this kind of cold detachedness from his wife. God's told him to marry a promiscuous woman, so he's like, okay, I'll do that. And so he does it obediently, but there's no heart of love towards her. There is a danger of taking that route of speculation. We don't know that. We don't know what Hosea and Gomer's relationship was like. We aren't given any more information than what is in these three chapters. So there is a danger of speculating. But what do we know? Hosea's not just some self-righteous, rule-obsessed nerd that is obsessed with kind of theology and like finding out all the rules that other people are breaking and pointing fingers at them, marrying a wife just so he can pick on her later. This is a prophet living in a time where everything is messed up. The one guy that God chose to bring a message to a nation that had completely turned its back on him. He's poetic, he's passionate, and he's preaching to this chaotic and corrupt culture of the entire country that he's in. And the fact that he's ready to follow God when God asked him to do such an extraordinarily difficult thing, something that is really going to hurt him, the fact that he would be willing to do that shows that he has a living relationship with God. And of course that would play out into the way he treated his wife. So if we are going to speculate, that's probably the kind of picture we should paint of Hosea, of someone who is not cold and detached, but warm and full of a joy that can only come from the Lord. And somehow in this strange situation, he still manages to show love to this wife. Yes, they are an extremely unusual and unique couple. And in this passage, she is clearly in the wrong. In the book of Hosea, it's her fault, and we're meant to take his side. And that's because it's not really taking Hosea's side. It's a picture of an even more extreme couple, God and Israel. They'd been joined together in this beautiful marriage in the time of Exodus. In chapter 24, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, and they respond with one voice, everything the Lord has said, we will do. As a nation, they were totally in it. They wanted this relationship. And God wanted it as well. He brought them out of Egypt so that he could be in this relationship with them. They'd willingly entered into this relationship, but they hadn't kept their end of the deal. They had turned their back and been unfaithful to the perfect God. Were they really that bad? Let me read you a list of some of the sins that are mentioned in the rest of the book of Hosea. Murder, breaking an entry, bloodshed, violence, theft, literal daylight robbery, fraud, deception, lies, adultery, corruption, setting up evil kings, tying themselves politically to nations they knew were evil, relying on military might to solve their problems rather than turning to God, worshipping golden calves, setting up idols, sacrificing to those idols, sacrificing humans, and using shrine prostitutes. And that's a shortened list. Israel had been really unfaithful. And so God has every right to disown her. She is not my wife, and I am not her husband. He's speaking to the children about their mother. We've got this rebuke your mother thing. The mother could be Israel in the past, or it could be Israel as a whole, and the children could be kind of Israel in the present, or a smaller group of people, kind of the people who are hearing what Hosea is saying. So I'm talking to you guys, but it's, and we're kind of separating the small from the whole, and that's the picture of children or mother. It doesn't really matter which of these two we use, whether it's the part of a whole or whether it's a past and the present, it kind of still stands. So what does God do to his unfaithful wife? Well, the verses 1 to 12 can kind of be split up into three parts. So firstly, verses 6 and 7, he stops her getting to her boyfriends. She's running out after them, and he hedges her in, blocks her way so she can't get to them. Partly this is to give her enough time to actually stop and think, what am I running after? Why am I chasing these guys? To give her time to think. Then she will say in verse 7, I'll go back to my husband as at first, for I was better off than now. Secondly, verses 8 to 12, he takes back the things that she took for granted. Verse 8, she has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her grain, wine, oil, and further on, lots of silver and gold as well. Back in verse 5, she thinks all these things come from her lover, that they have provided these things, not God. So his response is fair. He takes back the things that are rightfully his, that she has forgotten came from him. I'll take them all back, even your clothes. I don't care if you've got nothing to wear. I don't care if your boyfriends see you naked. It's not like they haven't seen you naked before. And at that verse, verse 10, it becomes really uncomfortable. But let's remember, it's a metaphor. It's about a nation. We're not thinking about a poor naked woman left on the streets. We're thinking about Israel. It's about God stripping away their beauty as a nation. The covering of the land, the clothing, the vegetation. See how he attacks the fields, the fruit trees, the vineyards. That's the clothing. Thirdly, the third thing God does in this judgment is putting an end to date night. Verse 11 is about these good festivals, the good festivals commanded by God. Times that he had told them to take off and spend celebrating the relationship that they had. It's their anniversary. It's the time they first kissed. It's the things that they like about each other. These are their celebrations in verse 11, but no more. And verse 13, you can see is quite the opposite. She's dressed up for date night, but she's going out with someone else. And so, it says, I will punish her for the days she burnt incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after other lovers, but me she forgot, declares the Lord. Me she forgot is actually quite a weird kind of sentence structure. It sounds like it belongs in Dr. Seuss or something. Me she forgot. Quite awkward. I think it works, but maybe it works better in Hebrew, but the reason it's in that order is to keep the last word as being forgot, to show us the force of what she's done to him. Now, what about us? I mean, we're not Israel. We're not so blatant that we would kind of head off for church. We're like, okay, we're going to church. Oh, wait, I've forgotten where it is. Oh, look, here's this temple. I'm just going to bow down to a statue instead. None of us in this room, I don't think, would do that. I've never done a burnt offering to an idol, and I don't think anyone in this room could tell me when the next feast of Baal is. No? But do we do some of these things in our own way? Do we go running after other lovers? Yes, Lord, I'm happy for what you've given. I'm happy for what you've given me. I'm happy in this, in what we've got together. But there's that one thing that you've kept from me that I need. I need to have that. If only I had that, then I'd be happy. You haven't given me this, Lord, but they can. I can only get it if I walk away from you. Or do we take God's gifts for granted? Do we fail to acknowledge that they come from him? Or worse, do we think that the good things we have are somehow wages from other masters, not gifts, things we have to earn from lovers who don't even love us? We don't even love them, but they have to pay us to get what they want. Or finally, the date nights, the festivals of worship. Again, that's different in our culture. We're not about to go and celebrate, you know, a Baal festival. But how seriously do we take our own date nights with God? Events in our calendar that have been set aside for worship, for celebrating our relationship with God. I guess the obvious one coming up is Easter. Do we think about that as a date night? Do we kind of plan it? Do we prepare for it mentally or in our hearts? Do we think about what we're going to say to our loving husband to celebrate just what our relationship means to us, how much he's done for us? Are there other ways in which God might be saying of us, me, she forgot? Now, it could end there. This is what you've done. This is what you deserve. My judgment. But weirdly, the next passage changes tone completely. If it wasn't there, it would be so weird I'd find it really hard to believe if I saw anywhere else these two passages next to each other. It just doesn't make sense. Therefore, now I'm going to allure her. Somehow, God's love is so great that in spite of this, he calls her back. He takes her back to the wilderness, back to where they first met, back to the basics where the relationship began, when they were walking together on those dusty sands, and all they had was each other. When she looked to him to provide, and he gave her manna from heaven, bread from heaven, she couldn't have gained it any other way. She knew that every good thing comes from his hand, that she couldn't live by working the land. She had to wait for his providence. Back when she was in her wedding dress and he was carrying her over the threshold into this new land that he'd prepared for her. But as we remember that point, there's a bit of a sour memory. There's mention of this valley of Achor, which means trouble, as we see in the footnotes. There's a sour memory of when she's entering the land, their home together, but something goes wrong. In the book of Joshua, just after the Israelites have entered, they've taken Jericho, that went well. One of the next stories is about a guy called Achan. And what Achan does is he keeps for himself some of the things that were meant to be devoted as gifts to God, showing their faithfulness to him and their thankfulness to him. He keeps them for himself, some silver, some gold, and a cloak. And because of this, the Israelites lose a battle that they should have easily won, and 36 people die. From then on, that place is called Achor, which means trouble. And every time they must have seen that place, passed that place, they must have remembered, this is where we messed up. But God's renaming it here. He's saying, let's forget that ever happened. Let's start again. Let's go back to when I was just carrying you into our new home. And let's forget about that next step, which was when you messed up. Let's rewrite that and call it hope. So as you enter the front door, you remember there is hope of coming back home. And the renaming continues. You must call me my husband, not master. See, the problem was, as we see in the footnotes, Baal means master. And the worship of other gods was mixed in to the worship of the true God. Even back from the time of Moses and Aaron, Aaron doesn't kind of make a calf and say, oh, by the way, guys, yeah, we've got the God that we're following. We're going to add another God over here. This is golden calf God. Worship him. He says, these are your gods, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. He's saying, here's the God we know, and this is what he's like. Taking a truth and mixing it with lies. Muddying the waters, confusing everything. God won't have that. He doesn't want us to think of him like the lovers. He is nothing like them. So he says, don't use the same words that you used with them. I am different. Don't call me master anymore. Call me my husband. Which is weird if you think about it, given what she's done. If anything, it should be the other way around. I was watching a show, and in it, one of the characters who feels betrayed, she says to someone, I'll always love you, but you'll have to earn my forgiveness. You'll have to find a way to earn my forgiveness. She's accepted them back in, but there's hesitation. There's kind of a locking out of the full intimacy that they used to have. This is the opposite. He's saying, you used to call me master. Now I'm giving a better name, a more intimate name. I'm drawing closer to you despite what you've done. Somehow his love has not diminished. If anything, it's stronger. Forget them. Remember me. Forget them. Forget the way that you used to turn to them as masters for your peace and security. I'll give you peace and security here with me at home. The next thing to do is that they've got to get pest control in, because as she's been out the back door in the night to go with her other lovers, all sorts of things have come in and wrecked her home. So he has to make a covenant with the beasts, with the creepy crawlies, the lions and bears that attack your people, the vultures that circle overhead reminding you of yet another death in your city, the foxes that eat your chickens, the locusts that eat your crops. I'll make a covenant with them so they won't be a problem. I'll get in pest control and clear out our home so it is fit for you to live in again. You won't need Egypt or Assyria to fight your wars for you, because there won't be any wars. There'll be peace and safety. You'll be safe at home with me. And then in verse 19, once we've cleared up the house, let's renew our vows. I'll go first, by the way. I'll betroth you to me forever. I'll betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion and in faithfulness. There is not a hint of hesitation on his part. He's not holding back. There's no coldness. There's no holding her at arm's length until it's come home. I'm waiting. I want to say these things to you. I'm longing to be at home with you together like it used to be. And then there's this wonderful song of blessing. It's a call and response song. You know what they're like. You sing one line, someone else sings another line. And the problem with call and response songs is that if the other group aren't cooperating, it sounds really stupid. You're just kind of left hanging, and you're like, can I sing the next line yet? I want to make music with you, but you're not paying attention. But when it does work, it's beautiful, and it's spine-tingling. So his song starts back in verse 14. It starts with a whisper when he speaks tenderly to her in the wilderness, where they spent their honeymoon. He talks about what they used to do, the way they used to be with each other. And as she listens, the memories flood back. And as she hears of those wonderful times, she remembers that song that they used to sing. And she plucks up the courage and she sings. And she thinks, will he continue our song? That song that we used to sing together. Will we continue it? Could it be that we could go back to where we used to be? Or Is he just going to leave me hanging? What's going to happen? We have to wait, but we see that in verse 21, he joins in the song. He gets so excited. He shouts so loudly that all of creation can't help but join in. His familiar voice, deep and powerful, the same voice that spoke the stars into being, the same voice that created the world and the plants. It speaks to the land to bring forth our blessing to her again. In that day, I will respond, says the Lord. I will respond to the skies, they will respond to the earth. The earth will respond to the grain, the wine, the olive oil, and they shall respond to Jezreel. Jezreel, in this instance, it represents Israel. The names are kind of more similar in the Hebrew. And the name Jezreel kind of is a pun for God plants. There's this cascade of blessing as he bursts into song, flowing from God to his bride, coming through nature, going through the nutrient cycle, the water cycle, all these things working together to make the home beautiful and fit for flourishing for his wife. She will be planted in the land again. God plants. She can, and I'm sorry about the pun, she can put down roots. She's here to stay. He's brought out everything she needs to flourish. He continues in the renaming each of her three children, each one of them representing an aspect of God's anger that's been turned around into blessing. And it's not just that these names have been reversed. They've been reversed and expanded. Somehow his love is still getting bigger. We see in the renaming of not my people, we see where we fit in. We as people who don't have a Jewish heritage, we were not his people once, but now we've been included. Somehow, strangely through this unfaithfulness, rather than his blessing being less, it is more and it includes us. If you don't believe me about the not my people bit, just look up 1 Peter chapter 2 or Romans 9. That's where it shows us that these verses talk about us as non-Jews. So that shows kind of how we fit in on a grander scale. But what about us as individuals? Is there any extent to which, kind of, when you read through the first half of chapter 2, that some of those things resonated with you? Do we feel sometimes as if we've let God down, like we've been unfaithful to him and are wondering whether he'll have us back? Maybe we feel that there used to be a time when we were close. We remember those honeymoon days, but we've not been as committed as we could have been. He seems further away. Let me tell you that right now, even now, not only does he want you back, but he's calling for you to come home. You see, this passage is very similar to the prodigal son. Look at verse 7. I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. It's very similar to the language that the prodigal son uses when he's out with the pigs. He's like, oh, being with pigs is useless. I've got no money. I want to go home and be back with my father. Now, the difference between the prodigal son and this story is that with the prodigal son, he's the one who kind of comes up with the idea of going home. And yes, his father welcomes him back and runs out to meet him. That's beautiful. But I would dare say that this passage is better. I feel bad for saying that one part of the Bible is better than another, but hear me out. It's better because God has already been calling her home. The things he does in chapter 2, if you look at them closely, they're not cold-hearted revenge. They're all about drawing her back in so that he can allure her. It's like he's followed her out the back door in the night when she snuck out, thrown things in her way when she's tried to get in her lover's door, called out and said, "Look, look how empty they are. Can't you see what you're chasing after? Come home." He's not pushing us away. He's calling us home. And all we have to do is respond, to continue the song that he has started. He said the first line. Let's with trembling say the second line so that he can continue the song of bringing us back. Because he is saying, "I want to be with you again." Let's just say it back. And to prove that this is not just a nice story, just an unrealistic, soppy, fictional romance novel with an impossible relationship, a cheesy happy ending, to prove that these are not empty words, God gives us a symbol that we can't ignore. Hosea, go show love to your wife again. Go act out what's already real. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites. The Lord already loves the Israelites. Show them what it means by loving this woman. Even as they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. Don't worry too much about what the sacred raisin cakes are. I don't fully understand that myself. There's something to do with the worship of other gods, but let's just leave it at that. There's then this problem. Hosea's got to show love to his wife, but there's a practical problem. For some reason, he needs to pay some money to buy her back. We're not sure if this is a bride price, if this is a debt that she's gotten into herself, or maybe if she's sold herself into slavery. We don't know. But he has to pay some money. It's costly. He does it, and he gets her back. It's an interesting detail to put in there, but doesn't it remind us of something? About the other man who paid a price to get us back. Jesus, the man who is a metaphor, not just a metaphor for God, but God himself walking the earth. In Jesus, we can see this picture of God as he calls out to his bride. Look at the words of Jesus as he reaches Jerusalem. This is in the end of Matthew or Luke. When he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often have I longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers chicks under her wings, and you are not willing." Don't we see how the words on the lips of this 30-year-old man are just the same as the kind of language that God uses about his bride, Israel? We see a visible demonstration in Jesus of the love that God has always had for us. And it's not just a demonstration, but in his death, it is the real and necessary payment, the practical thing that was needed to bring us back to God, to free us from our debt, to release us from our old master, our old Baal. So, Hosea and Gomer, they're reunited. They live happily ever after, or rather, we just don't hear anything else about them. That bit of the metaphor has been used, it's done, it's closed up, but a bit remains. What about Israel? Where's their happily ever after? The Israelites still had to wait quite a while before the experience of reconciliation actually took place. And actually, the rest of the book of Hosea seems to be more about judgment, more about the rebuke and the discipline that they were going to face. As it says in verse 4, they were going to live for many days without kings, prince, sacrifice, or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Why without king or prince? Aren't those good things? Well, they split off from Judah in the past, and when they became the northern kingdom of Israel, separate from the southern kingdom of Judah, what they did at that point was rejected the kingly line that God had placed, the line from which Jesus came. They'd rejected that line and chosen their own king. That's why the king and the prince is being taken away. Well, what about sacrifice? Surely God commanded sacrifice. And it's similar with the ephod. The ephod is a priest's clothing. But then when you put the sacrifice and the sacred stones together, when you put the ephod together with the household gods, we see that these good things had been corrupted and twisted to serve other gods. So what God's doing here is cutting them off from their lovers. He's preventing their worship of other gods, always with the aim of bringing them back to him. They're disciplined, but they're not being finally judged. It's part of his pursuing and wooing process. He's showing them how they've put their trust in idols, how they've taken him for granted, how they've taken what belongs to him and offered it to others. He's showing them that without him they have nothing, and that they should come back. And one day they will come back. And when they do come back, he's not waiting to say, "I told you so." But he's ready to welcome them with his blessing. And he's telling them this now, before the judgment comes. He's telling them this now, while they're still sneaking out of bed at night and sneaking into someone else's. He's showing them now, while they still have a chance to hear, so that they can see that his heart will always beat for them. He will always be faithful. And it's the same for us if we hear this. And if we find ourselves in the future in a situation where we think, "I just feel like I'm in the first half of chapter 2, trembling with fear and shame because of what I've done, because of my unfaithfulness to God." Well, let's remember the whole of chapter 2. If we're feeling distant from God because of what we've done, remember Hosea chapter 2, which has the tender voice of our husband calling us, "Come home. Come back to my goodness. I want you here." Because though we have been unfaithful to him, he will remain faithful. Look at the last verse here. And let me just read it as we close. "They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days." Let's pray. Father, when we look and see what we've done sometimes, it's so hard to imagine that you'd ever take us back. And yet we read here, you've put these two passages right next to each other. The passages that show the worst of what we've done, and the passage that shows that in spite of it all, you are actively calling us to come home and that you will welcome us. Lord, help us to remember that when we think that there's no way home. Help us to remember that when we've got a heavy heart and we think there's no way, there's no strength in us. There's nothing that we have to bring to you. Help us to see that your arms are always open. That you are faithful. And you will bring us home. To your blessing, because you are faithful. Amen.